Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, and Brendan Joel Kelly of the Anchorage Press. Brendan, Mayor Sullivan faces a rebuff from the Assembly on his so-called sidewalks ordinance, but the mayor is pressing ahead. You've been following this issue closely, and so has the Anchorage Press. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's a homeless issue, and it all started in late June when a homeless guy named John Martin started camping out in front of City Hall, right in front of the City Hall sign. And this guy is he's a first-degree sex offender. He's on the registry. He ended up getting arrested for, he had been listed as residing homeless near Campbell Creek, and so they popped him on that. His thing was, I want to talk to the mayor. He's upset about the mayor's recent camp abatement. This ties into another thing, which is on the cover of our newspaper this week. For the last year, the camp abatement law that the Assembly passed has been tied up in the courts because the ACLU sued over the length of time between the notice at a homeless camp and when the campers had to be out and how much time they had to get their property out.
What happened to the property?
The original ordinance the Assembly passed gave them 5 days. The ACLU said that's not long enough, and the ACLU prevailed. But during that, from July of last year until May 23rd of this year, there was no enforcement whatsoever. So what Lieutenant Gilliam, who heads the Community Action Policing unit, he said that before there were 50 to 75 camps, now there's several hundred because there was no enforcement during that period of time. So now they're enforcing it, and the Anchorage Responsible Beverage Retailers Association, ARBRA, which is headed up by Ed O'Neill of Brown Jug, they go out in their vans, and the police and the community members call when there's a problem camp. They do focus on problem camps, not on clean, well-maintained homeless camps. And this is basically, the two things tie in that John Martin is protesting the enforcement at all of it and wants to talk to the mayor, and the mayor wants nothing to do with them. So the mayor proposed this sidewalk ordinance that you referenced, which is based on a Seattle model. I believe other cities like DC have similar ones, which have to do with blocking pedestrian traffic during certain times of the day. The Assembly really wasn't interested. I think that their attitude, at least talking to, and it's not the mayor's allies, but talking to Patrick Flynn and Harriet Drummond, they saw it as, you know, using a bazooka instead of a fly swatter.
And the mayor didn't get any votes from his allies either.
No. It was 9-1 to indefinitely postpone, which just kills it. Yet the mayor's going ahead and giving this ordinance back to the Public Safety Advisory Commission, which is not the Assembly's Public Safety Commission. This is people appointed by the mayor, citizens appointed by the mayor, confirmed by the Assembly, and they're looking at adjusting it and maybe making it cover parts of Eagle River, talking to the Assembly members from those parts, Bill Starr and Debbie Osiander. So it's going to go on and on, and it's a continuous thing because now that we've got the enforcement back on and there's hundreds of camps instead of 50 to 75, people are moving from camp to camp. A camp will get cleared out, and people who got kicked out of a different camp will move in. It's just this cycle that it's fascinating because everybody's looking for a solution, but I don't see that anyone's found anything decent.
Thank you. Steve McDonald, now that the NFL has resumed, I'm wondering here if we can say the mayor kicked the ball out of bounds.
It
does kind of seem that way by sending it to this commission. On the other hand, he is keeping it alive, and there does seem to be this whole aura of this becoming an issue of how you feel about the mayor in general rather than necessarily the merits.
It's kind of gotten to that point. There were quite a few folks, I think there was about a dozen people who testified, which is, I think for an assembly meeting, it's kind of high, about this particular issue. And most seemed, I think all were against what the mayor was proposing, and a lot of them were targeting the mayor himself. He's gotten very lukewarm to to a, the cold shoulder on this in terms of response from the Assembly and from what the members of the public have spoken out on it as well. He wanted to have more time. He wanted to turn it over to the Public Safety Commission to have a few things addressed. He's hoping to come back in September. He was hoping the Assembly would keep it alive on the docket. That vote ended in a 5-5 tie, which basically killed the ordinance, and then the ordinance, then the vote was 9-1, like Brendan pointed out. So he'll go back. He'll try again. He can revisit this issue, and I think he plans to again. And as Brendan summed up, he's going to try and model this thing after what's happened in Seattle. Seattle is with that ordinance has withstood constitutional muster. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which the mayor points out is the most liberal appeals court in the land, upheld this Seattle ordinance, and it's kind of the model for other cities in the West to deal with vagrants and panhandlers and the homeless. So he's hoping that he can take some aspects of that and put it into an Anchorage law.
Kyle, I was wondering maybe we could give a try at this between us. The question of some people would be asking, Mr. Martin's received a great deal of media attention, far more than any single protester I can remember. In fact, there was somebody who stood out in front of the Daily News when Bill Clinton was elected for like 5 months saying the election, Clinton had stolen the election. How'd Mr. Martin get all this attention? Was it the convenience of him being in front of City Hall?
Well, that's if you want to get attention, camping out in front of City Hall, like under the City Hall words at City Hall, that's not a bad idea.
And now there are other campers who've joined, or rather daytime protesters, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, people forget that this guy, you know, this is the same guy who camped out in front of Abbott Loop Church. You know, he got a lot of coverage there. Yeah. This is the guy that the police put out some kind of missing person reports out when he was going to walk, like barefoot, walk to from Anchorage to Tyonek, maybe.
Mm-hmm. He's going to have to walk on water to do that.
His mom bought him a ticket home or something. So I mean, he'd been in the media before, but it never took off like this happened. I mean, I was out of town for a lot of this when a lot of this was happening, and just kind of reading it from the sidelines, and it really did seem to become a story of Sullivan and how people felt about Sullivan, and then John Martin and how people felt about John Martin, and if they excused the sex offender,
the criminal record.
Yeah. And neither one of the two main parties in this debate have come out very, very well. The mayor looks like he's, you know, a lot of people have cast him as, oh, you're just coming down on this one guy. This is sort of you're being vindictive. And Martin certainly hasn't been accepted as the spokesperson for all homeless by any stretch of the imagination. So a lot of people, I think, have said, I like what he's saying. I like what he's trying to do. We just don't want him to say it or do it. Maybe waiting a little bit and coming back in September, those emotions will have calmed down. But he could get the opposite effect of what he wants. He's supposedly advocating for the homeless and for the city to stay off their backs. It could wind up that city laws are even more stringent against people who are.
I know we got to move on, but what does he want exactly? I mean, does he want a place set aside for people to just kind of camp?
I think he wants just the city to stay off everybody's back. You know, just leave them alone. This is their choice, and they want to be out there. So just I think he just wants them to be left alone.
Well, in the context, if the protest was about I want to talk to the mayor, that's what. I'm not hearing that in this. I mean, the mayor could talk to him, and whether he shakes hands with him or not, say thank you very much, I appreciate your views, and the policy goes ahead. This happens day in and day out.
Right. Well, the mayor says he won't talk to him until he's presentable.
And one of my columnists pointed out that this could have all pretty much not been a non-issue if he had gone down there immediately and not spoken to him, not shaking his hand, said, hey, there's a process, go up and fill out a form on the 8th floor.
We need to move on, and we're going to move on with Kyle Hopkins. Yeah. Kyle, Vic Coring hopes to revise the corruption charges against him, and Bruce Weirach went to court, the federal court here in Anchorage, attempting to get his court costs paid in his criminal case, which he pled to a very minor, a misdemeanor, if I remember correctly.
State misdemeanor.
And so far, Mr. Coring and former Representative Weirach are not having much success.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try and keep this short, right? So Coring gets another day in court. He was acquitted on one, in 2007, he's acquitted on one of those charges. And he's saying, because I was acquitted on one of those charges, you know, I want any reference to accepting bribes, you know, accepting cash stricken from this new trial. So he's asking for that, and he's also asking for, as I understand it, a sit-down with Bill Allen to ask Bill Allen if Bill Allen would plead, if he was on the stand, if he would plead the Fifth when he was, you know, if he's asked about these allegations of sex with underage girls and trying to force them to lie under oath. So Coring is making those.
He's going to ask Bill Allen, can I ask you about underage sex?
Will you talk to us?
If we ask you about that, will you talk about it?
I'm sure Bill wants to talk about that.
I mean, how do you get in a room and do that? There's a whole legal process here, and Mr. Allen's going to have a lawyer.
Yep.
But I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Meantime, Y-Rock, he pleaded to a state misdemeanor charge. And considered that a victory, right, in these federal charges, and said, therefore, I should get reimbursed for like this more than $500,000 spent on legal fees. Judge said no, and the judge said, you know, let's close the book on this case. I'm done dealing with this case.
And he also said some version of don't come back.
No, and we're done talking about it.
Thank you, Kyle. Steve, is it possible that? This show may close before too much longer, the criminal corruption charges against politicians.
I think it's entirely possible. All of these have ended horribly. And the Department of Justice has been proven to have mishandled these cases in the prosecution against Senator Stevens and the others now. So I think that the Department of Justice will have to make the decision, you know, do we really want to press ahead with another trial on these? And you know, I would not be surprised if they just said, we're done. We're finished with all of this and time served good enough and call it good and that's it.
And although the prosecutors are not tipping their hand at the present time, and
right, yeah, and really, obviously, the key witness in all of these was Bill Allen. All these trials was Bill Allen, and the prosecution's going to have to sit there and can we put on a case? Can we prosecute a case without our star witness, who has been pretty well sullied in a lot of these things, obviously with these other allegations,
and has had health problems.
And has had health problems is right. So I don't know if they really have the wherewithal to go forward and put on an effective prosecution against Corin, Wyrek, all those cops.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Kyle Hopkins, and Brendan Joel Kelly. Let's skip ahead to Kyle Hopkins. Kyle, Hollywood is coming back to Alaska once again. Produced the film Frozen Ground, which takes up, it stars Nicolas Cage and John Cusack, two high-profile actors, to take up the story of Anchorage baker Robert Hansen. This was a story that rocked Anchorage some 25 years ago. You've had a chance to talk to people in the industry. Tell us more.
We talked to a couple of the producers on this movie this week. The news broke on kind of industry trade sites where they anonymously, you know, just said that Cusack and Cage were in talks to play these roles, and the producers say that they go a little bit farther. You know, they say, yeah, those guys they're counting on those guys to be in those roles, and in fact, they probably wouldn't have like leaked that to, you know, if that wasn't the case. But what's surprising about the timing is they haven't even come up here to do their scouting yet. Mm-hmm. They come up on Monday, and they'll be here for a few days, and we'll be kind of scouting locations. They'll be looking at what kind of crew is available. And then setting up shop in September and then filming in October. And this is like a, you know, $25, $30 million movie that's being produced by a guy who does a lot of just kind of violent crime movies. You know, he did the Rambo remake, like reboot in 2008. Stuff like that. And it's not based on the Butcher Baker book or another book. It's like an original script by this first-time writer-director. And we're just kind of waiting to see how that plays out. But it's just kind of it's interesting to see how it reminded everyone about Robert Hansen. Like a lot of people, even if you grew up here, I mean, you either forgot about it or like, you know, a lot of people are new and they weren't here at the time and stuff. And it kind of reminds you that, oh yeah, this was a really heinous.
And the two sentence description of the crimes would be what?
A so-called mild mannered. You know, you can argue whether he had been kind of identified as a creep. Even before he really got in trouble, right? But he targeted prostitutes. He was a baker. He would rape them and kill them. He would fly them out in his plane, and I was kind of hesitant to report this because I didn't believe the like really lurid stuff about that. He like would stalk his victims in the woods and stuff. But, you know, I pulled the file from the dusty archives this week, and you go back and you read those stories from the mid-80s after he's arrested, and, you know, he admitted to killing 17 women. He would, like, hunt them. There are, you know, as many as, 21 that he killed. And, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, when, and I think the movie focuses on the idea that there was a woman who got away from him and then went to police, and at first they didn't believe her, you know, because this was, they went to him, and he said, well, you know, she's just trying to extort me, and it took a while for those accusations to get traction. But in 84, he admitted to all the murders, and he's in Spring Creek right now. He's 72
and
years
it's
old.
It's kind of a tricky thing. This has happened before. I think it happened with both the book, Truman Capote's book, In Cold Blood, and the film of Cold Blood, that these were real events involving real people, and there would be real people here who, if they hadn't been involved in it, had some member of a victim's family or anything like that, certainly had some personal knowledge of these killings.
Yeah, you can tell, you know, the emails I'm getting are people who are kind of on edge about how this is going to be portrayed, right? There's Nicolas Cage plays a state trooper that, you know, catches the bad guy, and I'm hearing from police, you know, who worked at the time, and said, well, that doesn't sound quite right.
Well, presumably it's some kind of psychological drama. They've done this before, in which the police officer is challenged to outsmart the clever but not infallible perp, something like that.
Right. We don't know that much about the script, and they weren't prepared to talk about it, really, but maybe next
I'm not
week.
Lobbying to be a consultant. I'm just guessing. I've watched a lot of
He's got experience. He was in Everyone.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, thank you very much, Kyle. Bear attacks. Yeah. This, Steve, an unusual dimension of bear attacks. Four teens on a wilderness training course for young people were attacked by a bear. This doesn't happen every day, even in Alaska, where bear stories are a central part of our summer news.
Yeah. What's really odd, at least I thought was very odd, is they always tell you go into the woods by yourself, the chances of you being attacked by a bear go way up because you're by yourself, you're not making as much noise, that kind of stuff. Two people, the odds go down. These are like a total of seven people in this party. You would think that any self-respecting bear would still steer clear of that many people, right? But the circumstances, I think some of the experts that ADN talked to said this was like a lightning bolt. There was nothing you could do. And these kids were crossing a river, so you had the noise thrown up by the stream, by the water. Perhaps an outcropping of rocks also blunted some of the noise the kids were making, and when they came up, they surprised this bear.
I wasn't clear to me. Were there fish involved here? Was it there? Was the
not
bear
that
fishing?
I heard of. There's some speculation too that this was a mother brown bear and had cubs. I don't think anybody's seen the cubs, but they speculate that may be the case, and so she was just doing what bears do in those kinds of situations. Two of the kids were injured quite badly, punctured lung, bear threw them around pretty good. The kids, though, there's a bright side to all of this. Kids were on a survival National Outdoor Leadership School sponsors it. The kids were on their own. They had been out in the wilderness for 30 days. They had some adult supervision. They had reached the point in their training that they could go off on their own, and pretty much did everything right until help came. So kids really kept their cool, and thankfully everybody's going to go home, you know, all their limbs, and they're alive. So, but yeah, it was a pretty strange.
And there are going to be people who, with experience, who'd say, well, maybe they were just unlucky, and then there might be other people who'd say, well, they needed a firearm.
Yeah, this happened so quickly. A lot of people doubt that they could have gotten a good shot off when this happened. They had bear spray. It happened so quickly they couldn't get the bear spray out. So, like I said, I thought the description that the ADN had, where again the lightning bolt comment, I think it's apropos in this case. They just didn't have time to react. This bear was on them so quickly.
Okay, thank you. Alaska Newspapers closes, the rural newspaper chain that many of us are familiar with and has reach all over Alaska, is no more. And this affects not only newspapers, newspaper readers, but colleagues like Tony Hall, who appeared on this program a number of times, are now looking for work. Steve, what is the summary here of the closing of the Alaska newspapers?
It just reflects the hard times that newspapers in particular and the media as a whole are having right now in this economy, and also the changing changing ways that people are choosing to get their news now. But these were newspapers like the Phoenix, the Seward Phoenix Log, the Tundra Times, which had been around for Tundra Drums, which had been around for like 97 years. It served the Bethel area. Arctic Sounder. These are all very, very important newspapers
and
to
these
the
are
communities
Seward,
they serve.
Seward, Bethel are communities of pretty good size, and now they won't have a newspaper?
They won't have a newspaper. They won't have a newspaper, yeah. And it's just, you know, it's really difficult. You guys can attest to, I mean, we've got a statewide audience. It's not easy covering a state that's, you know, half the size of the country. You know, we see that great superimposed Alaska map over the United States. It's hard. It's very difficult, and it just proved very difficult for Alaska newspapers to keep this going as well.
Kyle, let's just speak to just how difficult it is to in this environment to keep newspapers alive, vibrant in their paper form.
Yeah, I think it would be hard to compare Alaska newspapers to like what we do. Right. I mean, it's kind of a special thing. When I heard the news, I was a little, I guess I'm naive. I was a little surprised because you would think that smaller newspapers are the ones that could do a little bit better because they have local advertising. And, you know, with just a little bit of local advertising and really local stories that you can kind of scrape by, you can kind of eke out, you know, a living as a newspaper. But I think their challenge was, they've got a far flung audience. They're sending newspapers to these to places where it's really expensive to ship to. So just kind of really, you know, just another disappointing development
and then there's the mechanics of shipping the newspapers, collecting the sales, having the money sent back to Anchorage, getting the advertisers in whatever community they're, maybe they're all major advertisers in big cities who advertise and who sell stuff in small places.
Yeah, I mean, you would think, like, Bethel's the biggest rural hub, right? You'd think Bethel should be able to support a newspaper. You know, I guess they do have the Delta Discovery, but, like, that seems like the kind of place where, theoretically, you should be able to have, like, a little local newspaper because you have little local businesses that need to reach readers in that community. But, clearly that wasn't... There was a report on APRN over the last couple of days that was really cryptic, talking to the publisher, ANI publisher, that said, you know, the headline was like, last minute purchases may save rural newspapers. But it sounds more like they just are getting, now that the news is broke that they were going to liquidate, that they're hearing from people who are interested in some of those assets. But it's really unclear how real those inquiries are, and if that might lead to some, like, you know, some or all of those newspapers maybe hanging on.
Okay, and that would be selling the assets, is the way it sounds to me, rather than, maybe it's just a hope and a prayer that it would continue.
Right.
Okay. Brendan, one of the Anchorage Press commentators, Mike Dingman, says, I'm a conservative, and I'm in favor of gay marriage. This is an unusual perspective, although some people might not think it unusual coming from an alternative newspaper.
From my
Tell
newspaper.
Us more, yeah.
Of course, we find the only conservative who's for gay marriage at the Anchorage Press. Mike Damon's a young man in his early 30s, and I think he's representative of sort of a new generation of conservatives. We were on talk radio together the other day, and so we kind of got a feel. We were on a conservative station. We got a feel for the callers and how they felt. His argument is conservatism, if you subtract the Christian, the religious element of it, is for small government, and that the more loving marriages we have, the more it strengthens the institution, and let's hear the arguments against that. There were a few arguments that we heard in the experience of talking about it on the radio and hearing callers, but he just believes that, you know, small government, stay out of your bedrooms. We don't need laws about who can get married and who can't. And also that led into a discussion about whether or not a contract that the government, you know, that I recently was married, and you know, you fill out paperwork, then it's a government contract. Should a marriage be something the government even administers, or should there just be civil unions versus your marriage in your church or your marriage with your friends at your friend's house? And that's what's not the government contract, and everybody has civil unions.
And how soon can we look forward to this?
His guess is that in a decade, most of the country will have same-sex marriages.
Steve, let's look to Washington. The song and dance that's going on there with the debt crisis,
yes,
as Washington turns. So what do we know here as we're about to go on the air?
Yeah, as of Friday, when we're taping here, Friday afternoon or noon or so, I think the House had taken up Speaker Boehner's proposal. I don't know how that vote ended up.
If they were going to vote on it, they'd only vote if he had the votes.
Right. It sounded like he had the votes. I know it's been postponed the one time because it looked like he didn't have the vote. So maybe he was able to convince some more folks to get on his side. But the Senate saying compromise between the president and the House. We'll see if somebody can do that.
Let's see if people are up to it.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Michael Carey. I will be away next week. We'll have a guest host, Lori Townsend. And I hope you enjoy the show, and I'll see you in a couple weeks when I'm back in town.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.